grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 188 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I can't tell you what it's meant for me over the last few years to have this show, to have the people that tune in regularly, to have the people that support us. Thank you so much for everything that you guys have done, from coming out to live shows, to tuning in regularly, to sharing posts on the internet, things like that. It's really, really meant the world to me. And conceptually thinking about this show and the fact of conversations that need to be had in this world, deep things that affect our society, that affect the way we live life, are muy, muy importante to me. It's something that I've always considered since I was a young lad to now, where we're going, what we're doing. And to think about this show and the people who have tuned in over the last few years, to think that now on my LinkedIn profile, which if any of you out there are on LinkedIn, you know that you get regular reports every week as far as who's looking at you, what companies are looking at you. And to know that in the last 3 months, some of the top searches on my LinkedIn profile have been employees of the CIA, employees of the Department of Defense, employees of here recently, Entertainment Tonight popped up this last week, had like 60 views. I had like 30 something out of Entertainment Tonight, and then there were another 30 something that were out of the Department of Homeland Security. Quite obviously, Dudes and Beer is making waves, in the very least, in the titles that we're covering, in the topics that we're covering, and the guests that we're having. And speaking of which, tonight, I couldn't help but do it. It came up a few weeks ago, and I mentioned to our good friend, psychoactive correspondent, Byron Burkhammer, that, hey, just so you know, it's the 75th anniversary of LSD. And I was like, you know, we really need to do a show on this. And unfortunately, it's been a couple weeks since that birthday. But Byron, welcome to the show. How are you doing this evening?
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
I'm doing good. Doing good. And thank you for having me, Chris. Hello to your audience.
Oh, absolutely. And you know,
good to be back.
It was interesting to me when it just dawned on me, you know, and I remember sharing it with you. I think at the time I'd lost all of my phone contacts. I had a phone randomly reset, and I sent out a message to people online like, hey, if you've been a guest on my show, if I've worked with you, please get in touch with me. And you were one of the people that did. Okay. And I was like, hey, just, you know, like, it was just the 75th anniversary of LSD since its first synthesis. And it's been a few weeks since then, but it is one of those things that, you know, being somebody that works in Ibogaine treatment, that works with the psychoactive, Byron, you were somebody that specifically, whenever you came on my show previously, I approached you shortly after and was like, I would love for you to be a correspondent in this. And it's for good reason, because there is so much research going on right now. Probably about every month, I post at least one article on the Dudes and Beer Facebook group about magic mushrooms being used for research for depression.
And that's a big thing lately.
LSD is really the big granddaddy of all of these things. I mean, of course, there were magic mushrooms centuries you know, thousands of years ago, whenever you go into South American culture, whenever you go into Native American culture, same thing with the San Pedro cactus and peyote.
And even the Celts and Druids in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. The concept of the mushroom, especially if you look at fly agaric, and for those that don't know, ladies and gentlemen, fly agaric is that quintessential mushroom that you see in all movies and all pictures where it's red with white buttons on top. Yeah. Very highly used in the works, at least the illustrated works of Lewis Carroll. That kind of stuff. And that goes way back into Caucasus tradition, even into some of the reason why we have red and white as the colors of Santa Claus. Because, you know, the reindeer in Siberia actively eat Amanita muscaria or muscaria, which is the red and white mushroom, the fly agaric, the fly cap, as it's called, which was commonly used in witches' brews, things like that, for flying potions. And it's interesting just to see that culture over millennia, the culture of mushrooms, the use of mushrooms, cacti, things like that. But when it comes to LSD specifically, that's an animal unto itself. Lysergic acid diethylamine is something totally different than what exists in those compounds. And the way it affects us is totally different than the way those compounds affect us. I mean, they're still psychoactive chemicals, but it's a little bit different. Explain some of that to our audience, Byron, how psychoactive chemicals work, how things like ibogaine work. Ibogaine is a little bit more of a dissociative than a hallucinogen in and of itself. But
well, you know, we have a lot of theories, but we do have some good science out there too. We know, for instance, like ibogaine, it's very dopaminergic in its action. It affects pathways in the brain that, you know, help increase levels of serotonin. You know, and so you have these kinds of scientific explanations why we think it works. We know that it causes a neural reset. Ketamine causes a background neural reset in the receptor side. So we know these scientific things. But with LSD, things like that, the other psychoactive compounds, we know that it's hitting certain parts in the brain that, you know, expand consciousness, and we know that. So when you look at it that way, when you understand that you have a pineal gland, and that pineal gland is, you know, we've speculated on what it does for years, but we know more now with the psychoactive compounds. We know that it's definitely being affected.
Yeah,
we know now that. It's more like a gateway to a multidimensional universe within your head. You know, and it's really exciting when you understand that the brain chemistry works with the pineal gland and works with your consciousness, and everything is consciousness, you're finding out. Aerospace engineers are even talking about this. You know, we go to the extraterrestrial question. How do they fly their ships? Well, we know it's consciousness now.
It's actually come out here in the last month or so. Defense One put out that now a soldier can telepathically control up to three drones.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, they've understood this lately. You know, in the past, and I say lately, I mean in the past 10 years, they finally figured this out. Everything is consciousness. Every point in the universe is connected to every other point. And if you need to go faster than light, there's only one thing they know of that can do that. It's consciousness. Thought. Speed of thought, yes. So when you have a psychoactive compound that can unlock those doors, it's really exciting. You know, what are the prospects for something like this? So we know this, and we've got just some great science going on now. You know, when you were talking a moment ago, you were talking about the mushrooms and the depression. that's an exciting thing. You know, when we have FDA approval now, yes, it is. It's very huge. And, you know, this is something that affects, I've heard, as many as 2 in 5 people.
Yeah.
You know, dysphoric disorders in some part of life, they'll have it. So, you know, when you have something like this, it's really exciting. And it's not a pharmaceutical that you have to take the rest of your life. You can microdose it, you know, in cycles and have lasting benefit. So it's all really exciting to me.
That's what I really find interesting. As somebody who has admittedly experimented with psychedelia. And I truly believe experimented with the right intention in mind. There was never really the party aspect of it for me. There were people that I got things with that was their reason. That was not mine. Numerous times was the fact that even whenever I purchased LSD, that I didn't even use it for a good 6-7 months. It was just the fact of it was around. It was around. It was available. But I was waiting. I was waiting for the proper moment. I was waiting for the proper time, and I meant to grab the sound effect. But and you know, very much the concept of Easy Rider, where they stop in the desert and go to the hippie commune, and the leader of the commune gives him a little tab of LSD, and he's like, "When you get to the right place and the right time, quarter this." You know, he's like, "Yeah, I'm hip with time," and of course that led to the vision of his death, all kinds of things. But it was very much the fact for me, it was a sacred thing. It was something that I was using in an attempt to reach something greater than myself, as opposed to friends I knew who were using LSD, mushrooms, things like that, simply for the euphoric experience.
Well, you know, and you'll always have that. You'll always have people that are looking at this. They're looking for a hit of something, a hit of a drug.
Well, it's a dopamine response.
Right. And we even use the term entheogen. And the reason we use the term entheogen when we talk about, say, plant-based medicines, we use the term entheogen to differentiate it from the drug culture. Because, you know, when we're using these psychoactive compounds, we're looking at the expansion of consciousness or a neural reset in the brain or something like that, some benefit that you're going to have that's lasting. So we use that term entheogen. But it's the different ways that people use these compounds. And, you know, I know that for a long time on the college campuses, you know, the CIA even distributed these things, you know.
And, absolutely.
It did. It attracted many people in the drug culture. But now what you see, Christopher, you see the psychedelic renaissance going on. It's an underground movement, but it's largely developed. You know, it's largely growing every year. I see it growing. But it's people that are truly looking to find something else, something bigger than themselves, something they're connected to. And for that reason, you know, people are becoming enlightened. And that's just – we just know that, you know, these are agents that will enlighten, you know, if they're used in the right way. So, yeah, you have those two different types of people that, you know – but that's what I see, the majority of people that are using. You know, I talk to young people every day, you know, at some point that are microdosing or they're using something for the first time. They'll just kind of hit me up and ask me, how do I do this or whatever. And, you know, I look at their motives. What are they using this for?
Yeah.
But increasingly, I see people using this for growth, spiritual growth. And that's exciting to me. Or they're looking for relief from depression or anxiety or PTSD, you know, these things. So that's what's exciting to me. You know, no longer is it the drug culture that has it ensnared, you know, and you know, they're the only ones that are, you know, responding. It's now people that are looking for something bigger.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, you have to kind of wonder whenever Albert Hofmann first synthesized LSD. And, you know, even the scientists, one of my favorite shows online right now is out of Vice TV, Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia.
Right. Oh, that's a good show.
I love that show. It's so beautifully put together. And when when he throws down the chemistry on screen in like 20 seconds, it's beautiful. It's amazing. My wife is like, oh my God, that's entirely you.
That's good.
But even to see him talking to people that synthesized forms of LSD, that are synthesizing forms of ayahuasca, ibogaine, things like that. It's interesting to see all of this really stem from the study of LSD and from the birth of LSD. There was not a lot of psychoactive pharmacology going on in the mainstream before Albert Hofmann synthesized LSD. There was, of course, tribal things going on in Mexico with mushrooms and cacti, same thing in America, same thing in Siberia, same thing in China. Even Japan has the laughing mushroom, which is commonly found here in America. I'm not going to tell people how to find it, but it's even more common than psilocybin. A little bit more on the nauseous side, but much more on the giddy side of things, which is why the Japanese shamans called it the laughing mushroom, the laughing gem, it's called. Common, hugely common. But even used by shamans, things like that. This stuff goes back millennia, thousands of years. The use of ergot, the use of old grain, things like that to create brews, to create tinctures. That's very much where Albert Hofmann first drew his work. Was from ergot, and it's interesting to even go back into the roots of America back in the 1600s and into the witch craze.
And they think a lot of that was connected.
It's pretty well documented that at the same time there was a huge ergot outbreak in the area, which is straight up the roots of LSD. Some forms of morning glory, their seeds have the same kind of effect.
Have you ever experimented with that, Christopher? Morning glory.
Yes.
What was your experience with that? Do you mind me asking?
Quite honestly, my experience was with morning glory seeds was very much making a poultice out of them, crushing them down, and then filtering them through hot water, typically with some marijuana stems, things like that. Not to tell anybody how to do things, but it was very light, very airy. I could see just by the And even now, years later, after having used LSD numerous times, just talking about it gives me ashes and makes me have that metallic taste in the back of my mouth. So it's hard for me to even like memory recall exactly what Morning Glory was like. But I used it regularly. I remember my brother had a huge outcrop of morning glory on his back fence, and I used to go every October and harvest the seeds, and I'd crush them down and make tea, and it was a very just light, uplifting, euphoric experience. Very, and that's the only way I can put it. It was not a visual experience. It was not a hardcore trip, but it also wasn't a hardcore tincture. It wasn't a extraction or anything like that. It was a pure hot water filtration. It was very uplifting and enlightening as far as the feeling goes. And I used to use it regularly. I'd make batches of tea all the time with it, with some chamomile and that, and a little bit of macerated stem, that kind of thing, to kind of, because it was a little harsh, very bitter on the taste. So, but have you ever had experience yourself with Morning Glory?
Not with that. No, I haven't. That's why I was asking about it, because I have not, but I have heard a lot of people say that it was pretty much what you described.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a slightly uplifting feeling, just kind of, at ease, at peace,
that thing.
And I've always just been real curious about it. It's probably one of the things I'd like to try eventually.
I'm a big fan of anything natural. I really think that, and granted, I'm not saying that there are not plants with toxicity, folks. I'm not an advocate of go out and take a few belladonna berries, because one belladonna berry is totally different dosage than three belladonna berries for you. Even one belladonna berry for you, like, our systems are totally different when it comes to that kind of stuff. So I do not advocate really random trying of things. I really much more ascribe to the survivalist mentality.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and that's how I am with ibogaine. You know, this is a medicine that's inherently dangerous in the hands of the experienced person, you know, that doesn't know about dosing or doesn't know, you know, quite how to use it. So, I'm that one too, with certain compounds, you know, but ayahuasca, it's a little bit safer. You know, you don't have to be as clinical with things like that. But, there are things that are tried and true. You know, we know how they're going to react. With belladonna, we know that it can be toxic.
What is your let's just get into this real quick, because we're talking personal experiences. What is your personal experience with lysergic acid diethylamide?
I've only used it once.
Okay.
I can't say that I've used it more than that, but I'll say this. It was very visual for me.
Okay.
You know, people are always asking me about one of the medicines we use at the clinic. 5-MeO-DMP, dimethyltryptamine. And, of course, you know that's the active component in ayahuasca.
Yeah.
But that's a very different experience than LSD. LSD, to me, was very visual. It was a very euphoric feeling. You know, it just kind of took me, you know, and had me in the grip. And, you know, it didn't last as long as, say, something like ayahuasca or you know, ibogaine or something like that.
Yeah, it's a few hours trip.
Yeah, but it was an intense experience, and it was a different experience, and it was far different from, you know, these other psychedelics. So, but I enjoyed it. I really did, and I would like to do it again.
Sure.
You know, and I'm like you. I kind of wait for the right moment, the right time to do certain things, and maybe I'll have an intention this time when I go into the work with LSD.
Yeah.
So,
I highly recommend that. I very much tried to get back to the centering point in life, and the fact of when I go to sleep, I try to go to sleep with like the intention of finding something, with the intent of looking for something within my dreams. Our dreams are not random things. They are things that my brain could not process while it was busy breathing. And processing food and everything else that it does. It's definitely a different reality there. It's definitely something that I think we quantumly take part in. I've had shared dreams with people. So for me, when it comes to psychedelia, it was not something, I guess really even just coming from a straight spiritual background, it was not something to be toyed with. It was not something to be played with. It was not something that, you know, was like, hey, let's go out. Like, I would go to raves to get my stuff, but I didn't use it while I was there.
Right, right. You were waiting for the right time.
Yeah, yeah. It was very much for me about experiencing the right things at the right moment.
Right, exactly. Well, and that's where you tend to grow when you use things that way, when you're looking for the expansion of consciousness. And, you know, it's just like you said, you were saying something a moment ago, shared dreams, things like that. And we ask, how could this be possible? Well, you know, that we're learning more about consciousness, and that is a function of consciousness to merge with other consciousness. You know, we understand that we're rivers running into each other, and, you know, the water overlaps. You know, it just does that. That's our consciousness.
No different than two computers connecting over the internet, just like right now.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, when we look at that and we then enter with the psychoactive compounds to facilitate that, exciting things begin to happen. So, you know, yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing that we're learning what we're learning. I think it's wonderful that LSD is coming back out into the open. There are people now that are using it for far different reasons than they did in the 60s.
Yeah.
And that's really exciting to me. When you're talking about microdosing LSD, when you're talking about using it as a therapeutic protocol, that is extremely exciting.
Well, you know, that's just it. It really does. And when you look back at the nefarious past of LSD, and let's just get into it. When you're talking about shit like MK Ultra, when you're talking about the CIA purposefully dosing people in public.
Oh, yeah.
When you're talking about the case of Mr. Olson right here in New York, right here in New York, Frank Olson supposedly jumped out of a window. There's a whole documentary on it called Wormwood. Yeah. Beautiful documentary on Netflix.
What role did he play in the Defense Department? Wasn't he the one involved in the
He was a bacteriologist.
Department? Oh, he was a bacteriologist.
At Camp Dietrich. Yeah.
Okay.
And
there was another gentleman that jumped out of a window.
He was very much a part of the beginnings of MKUltra. The whole reason supposedly for him quote unquote jumping out the window was the fact that he couldn't take the fact that the US government was involved with creating germ warfare and carrying on germ warfare. And it was because of his involvement with that that people dosed him and things like that. So a very interesting documentary called Wormwood. And so far, folks, it was so much that the federal government at one point compensated the family. All right. That's how far that went. Far as admission of guilt. They compensated the they were willing to compensate the family at one point.
Right. Well,
so if that's the case, it happened.
Oh, I believe that. I believe it happened. Oh, I believe it happened. There was another gentleman I was thinking of, too, that also jumped out of a window. I want to say it was the Walter Reed Hospital?
Yep.
I'm thinking, what was his name?
That was a general.
That was a general. Yes. He was in the
– Hold on.
I do remember. Yeah. Nah, I should know that, but
oh my God, I can't remember. I'm trying to Google it right now. But yeah, he was one of those that was full on coming out about UFOs, all kinds of stuff.
Yes, he was. He was very much involved in that.
Yeah,
and they had to get rid of him somehow for whatever reason.
James Forrestal. James Forrestal.
Yes, Forrestal.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. That is him.
James Vincent Forrestal.
Well, you know, and it's interesting that our government has used these psychoactive compounds in such similar ways, you know, with several different people. But you know, it's like you said, it goes back to MK Ultra. And, you know, these are unscrupulous people that have done some unscrupulous things, sure. And, you know, on unsuspecting Americans. That's the hardest part for me to understand, you know. How can we use this on our own people? But I know every country does this.
Well, so, not even that, though. It really, especially on the West Coast of America, dug deep. It went into the hippie subculture.
Right.
It penetrated a lot of what was going on.
Yeah.
And even to think about it in that realm of where the counterculture was at the time and the fact that the government knew that the counterculture was going on and that at the same time they were studying LSD and its effects on mass people. People like Timothy Leary were bringing it out to the masses.
Oh, yeah. And then you had people that were researching DNA. The guy, was it Crick? Is that his name?
Watson Crick. They were the discoverers of the double helix.
He says for a fact he was under the influence of LSD when he discovered DNA.
Yes.
So, I mean, these things happen. So, excuse me one moment.
Chris. That's all right. Is that a call you should take?
No. It's definitely not a call I should take. It's probably a telephone.
That reminds me, I should turn my phone to stun as well.
Yeah. Sorry, I would have thought to do that beforehand, but
me too. I am a show mode kind of guy.
Well, and you know, I'm learning how to be. You know, you got me as a quarterback now, so I'm in training. Okay.
No, that's what I'm saying. I do it for a living, and I had my phone still live.
right. Well, we'll get there. We'll figure it out.
I mean, you know, whenever you're looking at this kind of stuff, like you said, Watson himself was saying that he was under the influence whenever he envisioned the double helix.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a natural compound that was synthesized in a lab that could come totally naturally from things, like DMT occurs naturally in some places. Psilocybin occurs naturally in some places. It's interesting that nature provides us with these things.
It is.
And that cultures tend to key in on it.
They do. And that's something that I get excited about just about every day. You know, some days I just wake up and I'm thinking, I cannot believe things like this exist. Things like this are just natural. You know, they grow in the world, or they're in the, you know, system of an animal or a, you know, a toad or whatever. It's amazing to me. It really is. And you know, then to look at the history behind each one of these compounds, you know, each one of these compounds has a history somewhere. There is some culture that has used it, that has revered it, that has used it for spiritual enlightenment. You know, and when you see that, and you see this has gone on for thousands of years, it's truly exciting. But what really excites me at the moment is these things like LSD that we've synthesized and that we're using now and that we're rediscovering new uses for. You know, we're not just using it in a counterculture anymore. This is, you know, coming into mainstream science, if you will. You know, when the FDA is looking at mushrooms and you know, how they could possibly treat depression. Well, that's really exciting to me. So I do see this latest psychedelic renaissance we're having as just a huge thing, a huge deal.
Scientifically, it's an incredible new realm of discovery and of science that people have been trying to do for years. The unfortunate thing is that it's not that the effects of LSD haven't been studied in laboratory studies. It's that the uses of LSD have not been studied in laboratory studies.
And that, that, if you agree, is the truly exciting part. You know, we're, we're discovering what is this practical for? What are the pragmatic reasons we have a compound like this? You know, we've – so, yeah, I think that's wonderful. And I think it's – when you have people that are slaves to pharmaceutical compounds that just generally have deleterious effects on
a person, they just approved something 1,000 times more powerful than morphine.
Oh, good grief. What now? I'm like, still thinking of fentanyl.
No, it's more powerful than fentanyl.
Oh, my goodness.
It's like 100 times more powerful than fentanyl. And they just approved it for use. It's an oral pill. It's horrible. Horrible.
Oh, wow.
Like, so I'm not going to say that I don't have some people in my family that suffer some horrible pain, Byron. Horrible pain. Like, the only reason my mother danced at my wedding was because she had an electronic device, like, interrupting the signals of pain in her spine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the only reason she was able to dance at my wedding, and that's a beautiful thing. But unfortunately, financially, she cannot afford to keep that device in her for perpetuity.
Oh, wow. That's a and that's the thing, you know, we've had a huge problem recently with opioids. We're still having a problem with opioids. And I think our DEA is very unbalanced in their views and very unbalanced in their the way they're approaching these situations. You know, it's either all or nothing, you know, and consequently people like your mom are just being left out in the cold in many cases.
Absolutely.
I hate that part of it too.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't agree with all the overdose deaths, but I don't agree with all the people that are genuinely deserving patients, you know, being fired by their pain doctors because their pain doctors are too afraid to write anything anymore.
Yeah.
That part, you know, we've just gone overboard.
Well, but even myself with my anxiety meds, I had a supplemental, which granted was not a whole lot. But enough to make a difference on days where I was traveling, on days where my anxiety was going to be really high and knowingly really high. And I got a call one day from my doctor's office saying that because of new regulations, they would no longer be able to provide that. And if I wanted that for that reason, and this was like a 0.5 5 milligram or
clonazepam,
you know. Yeah. It's exactly what it was.
Yeah. Well,
if you would like to continue that, you need to go to a psychotherapist and you need to have that prescribed for you for that reason.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah. And that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate right there. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. You know, we have a problem with OxyContin. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's address the OxyContin. Let's don't just take everything out there and throw it all in the same bag. It's just not going to work.
Well, but, that's just it. It's just the fact of I was allowed 15 pills a month and I used maybe like 6 or 7.
Right.
You know, so I was far from a habitual user.
Right.
Somebody that even used my prescription to its extent.
Right.
But they were literally because of new regulations and what we are as a clinic, we can no longer provide this for you. If you want to get it, you need to go to like a therapist and they need to provide it for you for anxiety.
Well, and that's just unfortunate. You know, so many people are in that situation right now. But I tell you, there are a lot of things out there that I don't think should be prescribed at all. One of those is a medicine called Seroquel. Well, Seroquel is an antipsychotic. An antipsychotic is now being used for sleep. It's being used for anxiety. And that's a side effect it has. It causes drowsiness. But it basically puts people in a coma. It's highly addictive.
Sure.
You know, I've had to help a lot of people get off of Seroquel. You know, but you see, half the young people in America on it. And I, of course, I'm exaggerating. But you know, a lot of people that you know could do fine with something probably like psilocybin microdosed or you know, even Ibogaine microdosed or, you know, something like that. It's totally natural. This, yeah, it's a psychoactive compound. But when you're microdosing something, the whole point of microdosing is that you don't feel, you know, too much of an effect, but you have the beneficial medicinal qualities of the medicine.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I'm excited about. You know, no longer do we have to always use things like Seroquel that are just, you know, like hitting somebody over the head with a hammer, you know, puts them in a stupor. You've got compounds that can work with the body, work with the brain chemistry, enhance the brain chemistry. And I say enhance the brain chemistry and provide relief. That's what I'm truly excited about.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's some of the ways they're looking at LSD. That really is one of the ways they're looking at LSD. What can we benefit from this medicine? And they're looking at it as a medicine, no longer a drug, a medicine. You know, like I was talking about the term entheogen. You know, it's a differentiation. And now they're beginning to look at it that way, too. So I'm excited. I'm excited for the future. I'm excited when I hear things about MDMA-assisted therapy. I think that's truly exciting. You know, ketamine-assisted therapy. That's awesome.
And that's just it. We hear these things, even PCP. We hear these things, and we hear horror stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We hear mediaized horror stories about what the effects are, what the after effects are.
Yeah,
and there's always quite literal abuse of this substance. Not proper use of it, proper dosage of it. There has been some amazing work, especially and PCP is a different realm. Because as opposed to being a hallucinogen like psilocybin, like mescaline, like LSD, like DMT, it in and of itself is different. It's a dissociative. It's something that's meant to make you not feel anything. Almost put you into a comatose state is the idea. But there has been some very interesting work in the world of dissociative drugs and what they can do as far as therapy when microdosed, when used in small doses and properly regulated.
And you know, that's the thing I work with the most, the Ibogaine. That's the exciting thing about the Ibogaine. You know, we're now finding that, you know, we no longer have to just flood dose somebody to get the desired effect. We can microdose it now. You know, we're looking at new ways of taking it. There's a gentleman by the name of Greg Lawrence. He presents every year now at the Los Angeles Psychedelic Science Symposium. And that's LAPS. If you know, people want to know more about that. It's LAPPS. But he presents every year. And this last year, he was looking at doing some research on his own with microdosing Ibogaine and small amounts of cannabis to enhance it. Well, he came up with some really, really interesting protocols. And I've talked to several people that have used these protocols and gotten tremendous effects from it. You know, tremendous relief from depression. One gentleman, you know, said that, you know, he finally was feeling in touch with himself. He was feeling centered and grounded for the first time in years. Wow. You know, and he says this was all due to, you know, just using the Ibogaine in microdoses with the cannabis at times. You know, and he just felt extremely relieved, you know, and he wasn't even using that much cannabis with it. Yeah. He was maybe taking a vape. He was using a vape form of cannabis, and he was vaping it like once and then using the Ibogaine microdose. So
I really think that drugs like this, and I say drugs because especially LSD in its form, unless you're doing a pure extraction from some kind of botanical substance. You're right. synthesizing it, so it's straight chemistry. It's not right. cannabis. It's not necessarily ibogaine. Not necessarily mm-hmm. like I don't really consider ayahuasca a drug. Because it's just a series of herbs put together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So drugs are specifically something that have to be processed or synthesized.
Yeah. And that's why we use that term. You know, I've mentioned several times tonight, the entheogen. The entheogens can with the body. They're natural. They have medicinal purposes.
Yeah.
And of course, we're finding those things out now. Ayahuasca is another one. It's just fascinating, you know, what people are doing with it. They're microdosing ayahuasca now. A gentleman in Peru that sends you can order it over the internet. He sends out the ayahuasca. He says, "Okay, I'm sending you enough to make a tea every day." He said, "Make this tea, drink it every day." You know, it's microdoses, and people are just getting all kinds of benefits from this stuff. You know, and they're not on this prolonged ayahuasca trip that you normally have. You know, what do they call it, the yage. Trip.
Yeah, the 16-hour experience.
Right, right. This is just enough to do what it needs to do naturally, enhance mood a little bit. It's, you know, got some great effects. It's got medicinal qualities. It's, you know, expanding consciousness. But you're not tripping. You're not tripping real hard. And, of course, that's why people produce ibogaine. You know, people have they don't go into that dream phase, you know, that you do when you blood dose it. So I'm really excited. The microdosing seems to be opening new doors all the time. And why I'm excited about the LSD microdosing.
Exactly. And I think that people all too often look for that recreational concept.
Yes.
They don't. That's the concept that they have in mind. That's the idea that they have in mind. And when you bring it down to a smaller scale, when you're talking about a tenth of a scale, when you're talking about the experience of LSD without the trip of LSD, you know, when you're talking about that qualitative experience, because I don't know, just experientially amongst people that I know that have used it, it's there. That qualitative experience is there amongst people. Now, granted, I know some people that have had some bad experiences.
Yeah.
But before they went out and used this substance, they also failed a test, broke up with a girlfriend that week. It was not a period of preparation, which as with any ayahuascara, anybody, even treating somebody with ibogaine is coming to that understanding of you're going to confront some stuff here.
Right.
You know, and you need to prepare yourself to confront some stuff before you come do this. You know, and am I mistaken in that? Is that not a concept that beginning Zybogaine would follow?
That's definitely what we do. We always have somebody set an intention. You know, that's a huge thing. That's part of what we call pre-care. We want you to be thinking about yourself. We want you to start getting in the mindset. And I even have a therapist I work with. He's an integrative therapist. And he does sessions to help people come up with that that intention they need.
Sure.
They ask the questions, what am I going to ask this medicine? What am I going to tell Papa Iboga, you know, when he comes to visit? And, you know, people really do. And I think, Christopher, this is my honest belief. This is a very highly vibrational medicine. It's a very multidimensional medicine. And I do believe that people start interacting in their consciousness with this medicine even before they ingest it.
Okay.
That's my personal belief. Now, people call me crazy for saying stuff like that.
No, but I can't call you crazy for saying that. Good God, I feel crystals. I can't call you crazy because that's a fully qualitative thing, and it's the fact of its intent. It's what are you looking to get out of it? What are you looking for to begin with? And that definitely affects the outcome.
Which is why it makes it hard
to get qualitative evidence as far as the effect, because there is such an affectual effect. There is such an expected effect. How could you not say that it's placebo? Right. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. And you know, too, when I'm talking about people that when I say they're experiencing the medicine even before they ingest it, this happens frequently. People call me up, you know, I'm very nervous. Well, that's normal to be nervous about an experience you've never had.
Sure.
You know, anybody is. But I see other things going on, too, that kind of clue me in or tip me off that something bigger is going on, that they're having some kind of interaction. I guess it's just experience that I know these things and that I can see them. But that's literally what it is. It's that experience. I've seen it so much now that I can't ignore it anymore. These people are you know, having certain effects, that I would call Ibogaine effects, you know, and that's the interesting part to me. That's always been interesting to me. And of course, I use that space that they're in. When they get into that space, I will use that space that they're in to help them set an intention. Okay, if you're feeling the medicine already, let's start working with it now. Let's do it now.
Sure.
You know, and so they come up with these great intentions. They come up with, why am I going to use this medicine? You know, just any number of things. But those people are the ones that seem to get the most benefit.
Yeah.
You know, every time.
I've known numerous people that used LSD full on recreationally. They were recreational users. They used it a couple times a week. They used it in quantity a couple times a week, like to the point where like three hits just wouldn't do them. You know, and I can definitely say that they have definitely different experiences and different life experiences.
Now that's very true.
Than those that sought it and used it as a means of expansion.
Right. Well, and yeah, and that's exactly what I see with the people using that. I want to talk about them setting that intention. They are having a very different experience.
Yeah.
So it all goes back to, how are you using the medicine? What are you using it for? It's always that case every time.
Yeah.
So I just get really excited when I see these things. You know, when I say I use that space to start working with them. And I guess it could be any psychoactive compound. You could set an intention before you use any psychoactive compound.
Sure.
To, you know, see, what are you going to get out of it? What do you want out of it? I think people should always ask that question. You know, I know that people, a good ayahuasca hero, for instance, is going to tell you to do this as well with ayahuasca. He's going to tell you, or she is going to tell you, you know, set an intention. What are you going to ask this medicine when this medicine affects you?
Well,
what are you going to ask it? What are
you know, quite honestly, I've even gotten to the point over the last few years that, folks, this is dudes and beer. I'm not going to deny the fact that I've had a few beers this evening.
Oh, okay.
I've even had a couple before we started. But the question comes to bear, why am I drinking this evening?
Yeah, and you know, that's the thing.
My intention is not to get drunk.
Right. No, it's, you know, when I drink, my intention is to, you know, stimulate appetite. I like wine. I'll drink wine to stimulate appetite. I know it's going to do it. And, you know, it's also a great way to spend an evening, you know, a meal, a good wine, and good conversation.
That's
well,
it.
You know, that's
exactly.
That's,
for me,
right.
Yeah.
And you know, that's you know, one of the most socially acceptable, I guess, substances out there is alcohol. You know, some people have real problems with it. But if you don't, you know, really, there's nothing that can make an evening better sometimes. You know, and I work in addictionology, and I'm saying this, so forgive me. But, you know, there are people that don't have the issues. Some people, other people do, you know. Some people don't have a drinking problem. You know, for those people, you know, I'm all for it. You know, hey, if, you know, a couple of drinks relaxes you and, you know, facilitates appetite, you feel a little better, go for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, then again, the people I work with usually can't do that anymore after, you know, certain things happen. But, you know, it's, not everybody's an addict.
Well, it is a different mentality. And I myself have dealt with my issues with addiction in life. And it blows some people's minds that I can smoke some reefer here and there. I can drink, and I'm perfectly fine. Get me around some other substances, and I'm a horrible, horrible human being.
Right.
You know, and that's just the way it works. Doing other things do not make me want that substance or make me want to be around it.
Right.
So it is very much learning to know yourself, learning to know your triggers, learning to know, like I said before, and like we were saying before, when the right time to use these things is. If there is a right time, if it's even for you.
Right.
I think that's unfortunately what our society brings us to more often than not is this concept of if you haven't, then you're less than.
Right. Yeah, and that's true. I mean, that just happens. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. It just sounded like total silence for a minute.
Oh, no. I was contemplating that because, you know, it's something to think about.
It is something to think about. It really, really is. But, yeah, I mean, that's – you know, you have different people that use things for different reasons, and, you know, it's all back to that. But, yeah, there's you see any number of types of things with the Ibogaine, the ayahuasca – LSD even. So I don't know. I think that we're some new territory. You know, it's a new frontier. I'm very excited about the current renaissance we're having with the psychedelics. You know, and I just wonder where we're going to be 10 years from now. I really do. I think the faith says
I think that with the cultural acceptance of cannabis and marijuana, that's definitely entered a new world where we can give some qualitative study to these substances, much more than the arcane study that's been done. Because unfortunately, the realms of MDMA, the realms of DMT. And LSD have been the fringes of science.
Right.
And amongst those that if you study them, you may as well be saying that, like, there are objects on the moon, you know? It puts you into this realm of arcane science of people that are uncredible.
And that's very true. That's very true. Incredible things are happening, and I really look for more. But it's like you just said, it's the socially the social norm is changing, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, things are becoming more acceptable than, you know, they were. You know, one time you had a movie called Reefer Madness. I referred to that a little bit ago.
I own a copy of that. Madness.
Well, and it's just a crazy movie. You know, it's pure propaganda. You know that.
It's madness.
But now, you know, yeah. But, you know, now it's changing. It's changing. People are actually looking at what are the therapeutic benefits, what are the medicinal benefits for these things, you know, for marijuana and specifically. And then these other psychoactive compounds. So we're going to get there. I know that we will. I know that we will. And I'm very excited for the future.
And same here. And that's where we leave this episode this evening, folks, is the fact that there is a great horizon of research to be done.
Right.
The fact that we are just out – like, it's amazing that LSD is now 75 years old.
Yep.
75. Yep. It didn't even hit the mainstream. Mm-mm. Until 25 years after its first synthesis.
Right, right.
That's how long
he
had been working on that.
Yeah.
And to know that just now we're starting to really crack the nut of what it can possibly do is amazing.
It
brings me right to the point of where I was a couple weeks ago at the NVIDIA conference, where I heard a guy talking about chip manufacturing and the fact of Moore's law is mute. It's dead. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. The whole concept of how chips and CPUs grow is just gone.
Yeah.
It's obliterated with modern technology.
Now there's a what do they call it? Rose's Law? I guess after Jordy Rose, the D-Wave.
I don't want to get too crazy.
Yeah, well, but, you know, that's a totally different ballgame there, you know?
Exactly.
But, yeah, I mean, things are just changing at a rapid pace all the way around.
And that's just it.
Medicine. Yeah.
We have to be ready to change with that. We have to be ready to move with that. And we have to be willing to be open of mind to understand that these things, these plants, these compounds, like ibogaine, like LSD, that have been used traditionally for years. Are out there and they're available and they're useful, and that there's a reason why people and cultures have used them for thousands of years. So on that note, tell everybody where they can go to find out more about Beginnings Ibogaine and the work that y'all do there, Byron.
Okay, well, our website is www.beginningsibogaine.com. You can call the 800 number is 1-800-649-2399. You can reach me personally. My name is Byron Berkhammer. My number is 903-707-0258. We have some testimonials. I'm about to get those on YouTube.
Great.
So we'll have a dedicated YouTube channel. We're starting that up. But yeah, if you go to the website, www.beginningsibogaine.com, you can find out what you need.
Fantastic. And once again, thank you for joining us this evening, Byron. Please do hold the line.
Thank you for having
me. And while you are online checking out the work of Beginnings Ibogaine Clinic, please do check out dudesandbeer.com as well as our parent network, hcuniversalnetwork.com, where you can find all the awesome podcasts like Yes But Why, Talking Sound, Scary Dad, Gray Matters, all kinds of great stuff. Until next time, everybody, if you can't be good at it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.